And now, the tradition continues as WABC presents John Gambling with the mayor of the greatest city in the world, Mike Bloomberg.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome aboard. Yes, indeed, the John Gambling Show Friday edition with Mayor Michael Bloomberg is on the air once again. Mr. Mayor,
good morning. How are you?
Welcome. Couldn't be better.
Going to be a nice weekend, weather-wise, although a little bit of rain on Sunday, maybe.
Well, that could spoil a few things, but we've had a stretch of weather here. It's been
we have had good weather, absolutely. If you had a vacation schedule the end of the summer, you probably did better than the beginning of the summer.
Yeah, it's worked out really, really well. We have a guest in the studio today. You have brought along Dr. Alan Alvilez, head of the city's...
Avilas.
I apologize.
That's all right.
Head of the city's public hospital system. Alan, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Alan's done a spectacular job. We have 11 public hospitals in the city. And the thing that I get most impressed about and keep saying again and again, there's an every three-year process where all hospitals are rated by an independent accreditation board every 3 years. And these 11 hospitals are rated right at the top. You can't get any better. You get the top quality, the best health care available. It's available elsewhere as well, but when you go to New York City Public Hospital, you can be assured that the quality of the care is spectacular. And Alan did something starting, I guess, today on the internet that is unprecedented in this country. You want to tell him?
So what we're doing is we're actually trying to provide the public with data that actually substantiates the good things the mayor says about the quality of our care. So for the first time, we are making available to the public an assortment of quality and patient safety related data that includes hospital specific mortality rates and includes the rates of hospital acquired infections in our hospitals, which are causes of preventable patient deaths in many cases.
We all hear about hospital caused infections. I mean, it's on the rise across the country in almost every institution.
Well, remember, hospitals are dangerous places.
Well, exactly.
You
that's my point.
Drugs, you have disease, you know, it's that's why you go there.
And the Federal Centers for Disease Control estimate that upwards of 100,000 patients die each year from hospital-acquired infections, most of which could be prevented.
We see these numbers come out of other hospitals, private hospitals as well. Are the ones that you're releasing different in any way?
Well, you know, you don't really see them come out of private hospitals here in New York State because there's no mandatory public reporting for this in our state. There are three states in the country that now have started public reporting on these hospital-acquired infections. I mean, so it's hard for me to tell you how we compare with others, and that's part of the point. That the more we are transparent with this data, the more it helps all of us to really focus on where we really stand. It's like turning on the lights in a dark room. It's hard to improve things in the dark when you're stumbling around. We think we turned on the lights for the
Let me be a little bit less diplomatic. I think it's fair to say that a large number of hospitals and hospital associations do not want to release any data. Partially because they have to explain away what's going on, partially because I guess they'd argue there are liability issues, and if they were to get sued, which you know, hospitals get sued all the time, you know, you're going to have some deaths in a hospital. So if you want to focus on the deaths, there's always going to be deaths. And for big inner-city hospitals, the big teaching hospitals, those that really have the best expertise, in many cases, their mortality rate's going to be higher just because... You know, that's where you go if you're really, really sick. And if you're really, really sick, the likelihood of you getting better is less than if you just have broken an arm.
To that point, I can understand from a professional standpoint how what you can turn the light on here and you can see some things you haven't seen before. But from the patient's point of view, from the public's point of view, can't they be misled by these numbers?
Well, you know, you do have to be careful about how you use these numbers and what you represent in terms of what they might mean to the average patient. At this point, we're at the very beginning of a process that hopefully will lead to more and more data becoming public and for the public to have a deeper understanding of what to make of that data. But at the very least, the data we put out shows what we're focused on improving, and it's data over a couple of years, in some cases over 4 years for mortality data, and it shows for the public hospitals that over the last 4 years, our mortality rate has dropped each year for 4 years. If we had the same mortality rate in 2006 that we did in 2003, more than 300 additional patient deaths would have occurred in our system. So that tells us, and I hope it tells the public, that
number
we're focused
one,
on the right things.
He's making a big difference. Two, there's a little bit of an elitist business to this. Well, the public's not able to understand the data, therefore let's not tell them. We have an obligation to get information out to everybody. In the case of these hospitals, they're publicly owned hospitals. The data is the public's, and we're trying to do the same thing with crime statistics and education. We can talk about that later on this morning and other things. But also, you know, you have a right to get the numbers. If you want to misinterpret them, that's a shame. If the press takes them and sensationalizes the bad parts, that's a shame. But you can't have it both ways. You can't have the First Amendment and censor. And this is a kind of censorship that a lot of people, a lot of hospitals and hospital associations want to do, and they do it under the guise of, well, the public can't. It's too sophisticated for the public. And I don't believe that.
Are you looking to force the private hospitals to do the same thing?
Well, it's not our business to force anybody to do anything. We're going to do what we think is right. Alan's led this charge. I didn't push him into it. I didn't have to. Reason he's got the job is because he's one of these people, I think, that believes in getting information out and improving. And the fact that the hospitals, if we look at our own data, things have gotten better. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to look at the trends. You can question what the numbers mean, but the trend is going in the right direction. That should give you comfort, particularly if you've got a hospital like our 11 HAC hospitals where the public's paying.
How about the administrators of the various hospitals? What was their reaction to this?
Well, it took us a full year to sort of prepare everybody for the fact that we were going to be doing this. There was a lot of trepidation for the very reasons the mayor said, that there's concern that the data will be looked at only to try and divine the negative aspects of it. But, you know, when I look at this data, you know, it clearly shows that there's improvement, further improvement that needs to be done. But it also shows, if you look at the data that relates to how well we treat patients who come to us with heart attack, heart failure, pneumonia, that we score among the highest in the city. Because those are categories where the data is publicly available. Mm-hmm. We've included this in our website as well. And if you look at there are more than 60 hospitals in the city. If you look at the top 10 performers in the categories of heart attack care, heart failure care, pneumonia care, five of those top 10 are HHC hospitals.
Very good. Where's the website? The city website?
You can get anything. Go to nyc.gov and you can get there. From there.
Yeah. All right. Alan, pleasure to see you. Congratulations on the improving numbers. I'll be interested to look at these.
Thanks so much.
All right. Thanks for coming in. Mr. Mayor, sit tight. We've got more questions. I've got to take a break. We'll do that. We'll be right back at 77 WABC. We continue. John Gambling, Mayor Michael Bloomberg, and you right here at 77 WABC. We're talking about hospitals. Did you see the article in New York Times today about the Jay Selikoff Center for Occupational and Environmental Medicine and the 911 testing?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of this is, you know, different people can interpret data different ways. But I think one thing is clear, that there are real health consequences to those who were down at the site during the recovery and rescue and then recovery, and there's just no question that 9/11 health effects are serious, and that our fire department and our from the program at Bellevue Hospital and the World Trade Center Health Registry confirmed the problem, and Mount Sinai's data is in there as well. Last September I asked Deputy Mayors Gibbs and Schuyler to take a look at it, and we concluded that the fire department and Mount Sinai and Bellevue programs, which we've termed centers of excellence, really have to be the core part of our ability to address this problem. And they've developed a lot of expertise. They've got an enormous amount of data. Interestingly, the fire department data is the best data because fire department...
Well, even this article acknowledged that.
They have data going all the way back. So you know what people were before then. If you're just starting at that time, the science is more difficult. But we formed a medical working group from experts in the city government and out, including Mount Sinai people. And we've asked them to look at the latest research and the latest techniques and treatment. And the bottom line is, when you get all done, we need these centers of excellence to go on, and we need other 9/11 programs, and we got to get some federal monies to pay for it, because the cost of providing medical care to people who really are sick will be significant going forward.
Also, there are legal ramifications here as well.
There's nothing you do, which isn't. And it's like with the data we talked about from the HHC hospitals. The lawyers always say, oh, don't release anything because that gives somebody that's suing you ammunition. But, you know, the truth is the truth, and you got to get the data out there. And then my attitude is the lawyer's job is to deal with that, not to manage the data. You can't totally do that. Companies obviously try to put the best foot forward and protect themselves, and that's understandable. But I think what you're really seeing that at Mount Sinai with this article is simply different doctors can interpret data different ways. And if you work with it all the time, you probably think that everybody has it. 70% of the people show up have something. Yeah, but that you don't know how many people didn't show up. Maybe an awful lot more people didn't, so the number is a lot smaller percentage. But what is clear is some people really do have serious respiratory and other problems that come out of breathing the air back then.
And, of course, the fear that lingers because, again, there are no hard and fast answers here.
There are no hard. You know, I said that at the beginning, and I got vilified, of course, in the press. What do you mean? We demand an answer right now. It's not the way medicine works. Most times you can never, with 100% assuredness, know what the cause and effect is. And you just can't. You get different results with different people with the same symptoms with different medicines or the same medicine. Medicine is still in its developmental stages. There's a long ways to go. We don't know everything about all this. And that's why one of the reasons why we've been so adamant of working with the EPA and making sure that they don't relax their standards downtown. We've got to get the Deutsche Bank building down.
What's the status of that?
We are still working. We're trying to get... we've asked the fire department to come up with things they want in the building. We've presented that to the LMDC. We've tried to work with the EPA, but we've got the EPA doesn't want to relax standards, and I don't think they should. If you remember, everybody's yelling and screaming, get the building down quickly, let's do it right now. Well, just go back and read the papers 2 months ago. Everybody's yelling and screaming, let's make sure the air is safe. And our first priority is to keep people safe. It was a great tragedy in terms of the fire and two firefighters killed, and exactly why, that's lots of investigations going on. But you have to make sure that we can protect our first responders going forward, learning whatever we've learned out of this. But at the same time, let's not forget what we're trying to do. We were bringing down the building slowly and carefully and protecting the environment, and every monitor shows no release of pollutants into the air during the demolition. Now they get it down to the 26th floor. We want to get it going, and it's not going to start up again until we're satisfied that our first responders are safe and the people in the area breathing the air are safe.
Does that slow the whole recovery and building process?
Well, anything slows to some extent. You just hope that it isn't such a significant contributor to slowness or delay that it hurts other things. I mean, there's always, you can catch up here and there, and there's always some slack built into schedules. But, it's not good.
Larry Silverstein, I think it was just yesterday, wasn't it, unveiling some of the new designs that he plans to build down there. Are you pleased with what they've got on the table?
Yeah, I mean, it'll be a little while before those are up, but they are digging the new bathtub. The Freedom Tower is going up. The World Trade Center Memorial is going up. We continue to raise money for it. Anybody wants to send us some money, we're happy to have it. The criticisms for the last 6 years, I used to routinely criticize Pataki, and I used to routinely defend him. This is not simple. There are so many different parts of government, federal, state, and city involved, and the private sector, so many different moving parts, so much interrelated in terms of design. You move one little thing in your design, and it not only impacts your design, it impacts other designs of other buildings at the site, and you can't do it till they sign off, and then there's the cost and security and, all sorts of things. It's a complex site to do any work on. But if you go down there, I drove by yesterday, and coming back from Brooklyn, and the number of cranes that are up above the fence, because I didn't have a chance to look down, we were just driving by, I just happened to notice above the fence, was really quite astronomical.
Speaking of construction, I ride by on the train, Shea Stadium, the construction of that new stadium, the construction of Yankee Stadium, coming along quite dramatically.
I'm told on time, on budget, both of them. They both will be ready for the 09 season, and in 08 we're going to have the All-Star Game at Yankee Stadium, at the old Yankee Stadium.
Where else would you have it?
That's what we tried to convince Bud Selig, and somebody did.
Mr. Mayor, we've got lots more to discuss, and of course we'll be opening the phones. Your questions at the end of the program, 1-800-848-WABC, 1-800-BC. We'll be taking your phone calls in a little bit, 1-800-848-WABC. Mayor Michael Bloomberg and John Gambling here at 77 WABC. Cab strike yesterday, I never quite understood it from the beginning.
Well, I didn't quite understand it either, but I'm just glad it's over. The public wasn't really inconvenienced. The group that wanted to get some press and express themselves certainly did manage to do that. Big cost to a lot of people.
GPS, though, and the high-tech stuff is still going to go in.
Yeah,
right?
This is in the public's interest, and we made a deal with the taxi industry back in 04 and gave them a raise, and then in 06 another taxi fare increase. 100% of one went to the drivers, 70% of the other one went to the drivers. The deal was they would get the raise in advance and put in the technology. That was the, because we have to explain to the public why we're giving a raise to the taxi drivers and fleet owners and whatever. It's a regulated industry. And I stood up and said to the public, we're going to give them a raise because we want to get have drivers who can afford who take the job. We need people driving these cabs. Otherwise, you don't have the services of taxis, yellow taxis, which we do need in the city. But in return, you, the public, are going to get a better product. And that's exactly what we're doing.
During the commercial break just a second ago, you and I were talking about the numbers on Wall Street today, and you're concerned about the economy.
I am very concerned about the economy nationally, and it's got to happen here, too. Housing market slows down. That ripples through the economy. Wall Street profits are going to be way down. That's obvious. The whole deals business, which generated a lot of the profits for the last couple of years, has really come to a screeching halt. And big real estate transactions, probably the days of those are over. And that's going to have a very material impact on the tax revenues coming into the city. And today I actually sent out a message to all of the city agencies telling them that, you know, we have to maintain our commitment to fiscal prudence. And we see problems on the horizon. Now's the time to take a real good look as to you know, who we're hiring, try to not add any more programs or staff than you absolutely have to. And that's one of the things. That may or may not be enough. As you know, we're in the middle of another program to eliminate the gap. Our budget for this year was okay, and for the next year was deficits in the year after. Those deficits are real and, in fact, probably will be bigger than what we projected. It's a good thing that we didn't spend all the money in the good days. We did cut taxes a little bit. We said it was for 1 year. I'll have to see whether we could afford to do that next year or not. Just too early to tell. We put a few years, we put $2.5 billion away towards the $50 billion liability the city has to pay health care benefits for its employees down the road. We prepaid some expenses, thereby reducing the deficits for fiscal 09 and 10, but there's still some there, and they're growing.
You wouldn't call what you just said a hiring freeze.
I would certainly think that any agency that thinks they should be growing in terms of total employment, given what we face, should rethink those plans. We don't need to freeze totally, but it's not a time to be expansive. I think that's the first step, and then we'll see. You know, over the next couple of months, we'll get a better idea. But we are not going to make the mistakes of the 70s. where we got ourselves in a situation where there was no hope and we cut services and allowed crime to go up. Keep in mind, crime rate in the city is continuing to go down even while it's going up in the rest of the
country.
Murder
rates as low as they've been, right?
We want to keep that going. Schools are getting better. We've raised our teacher salaries. We can attract great teachers. Want to keep that going. Streets are cleaner. We have this new scout program. We're out there, 15 of these scooters. Actually, they're still in cars because they haven't passed the motorcycle test. You got to have a motorcycle test to drive it, but they're getting trained the end of September. By October 1, they'll be out there. And we're reporting already an awful lot more potholes and broken signs. And
are these
graffiti.
The segways, the two-wheeled things?
No,
scooters.
The three-wheelers enclosed. So it's one person in there. They have the little BlackBerry. They see a pothole, they hit the pothole button. They see a graffiti, they hit the graffiti button. And it logs it automatically, sends it through the 311 software to the agency who's responsible, but you know where it is because the GPS in the BlackBerry, and you know what it is. This is a human being who's trained to know whether it's a pothole or graffiti, whatever. It's not totally automatic. And then the next step is, and it'll be a year from now before it's done, but we're not going to leave office before that data goes on the web instantly. And you can go to something called City Maps where you can look up your building, and you'll be able to see every violation. You'll be able to see every pothole reported in the area. You'll be able to know how far it is to get to a hospital or a subway stop or whatever. You'll know the building plans.
Do you envision Wi-Fi for the city of New York?
No, I don't think you want Wi-Fi. WiMAX will keep Wi-Fi from ever going in. But WiMAX is certainly coming to this country, and you will just have...
What is WiMAX real fast?
WiMAX is a much bigger, more robust system where you'll have... Wi-Fi works within a building or within, a block. WiMAX, it will be fundamentally like your cell phone service. Okay. You have cell phone service essentially. There's spots, but every place, that's what WiMAX will give you. Enormous speeds, much greater than even Wi-Fi, available every place.
Interesting. You did an old-fashioned survey. You talked about it here before in anticipation. The numbers are out now of the school system, from the teachers to the pupils, to the parents, to the principals.
We had 500,000 responses. I don't think anybody's ever done a survey that big other than
surveys
national
are about
census.
10%. Survey response is somewhere in the 10% range.
Yeah, and we had much better than that, but also nobody would survey everybody. We sent the thing to everybody, asked every student, every parent, every teacher. And the fact that we got, a very big percentage that responded means the numbers really mean something, and it's interesting. You know, everybody's got bitches, and of course that's what the papers focus on, but there are an awful lot of people very satisfied. And some things are just counterintuitive. You hear people scream, we're teaching to the test too much. By a factor of 10 to 1, parents said, I want my kids better trained for tests.
Well, that's because then they respond, and people believe that the tests actually lead to learning.
Look, John, if the test is, can you read? Yes, we're teaching to the test. If the question is, can you add 2 and 2? We're not teaching you to add 2 and 2. We're teaching you to add. So if the question is 3 and 3 or 4 and 4, you should be able to do it just as well as 2 and 2. The real world is full of tests every day. Your employer tests you all the time.
Every day.
And, people that say, too many tests, I don't know what they're thinking.
What did you learn? What was the one surprising thing that you learned from this?
People wanted, by a factor of 2 to 1, double the number of people wanted more money spent on enriching programs as opposed to class size. Class size is something we want to work on. We are bringing it down. We're building more classrooms. We've got the biggest construction budget ever seen and all that sort of stuff. And we really are. We're hiring more teachers all the time. So we're going in that direction. But class size, as compared to better teachers and enriched programs, it's the better teachers and enriched programs that most professional educators would say the science shows are really important. And the parents seem to think that.
City Council, one of their committees, saying your cell phone ban is wrong. The City Council to vote on it on Monday. They say they're going to veto it.
The mayor's veto. No, I vetoed it.
They override it.
The mayor's veto is always overridden by the City Council, pretty much always. It's a meaningless bill. You have a right now to do exactly what this bill gives you. You can bring a cell phone to school. You just can't bring it in school. And we're not going to change. Schools are for learning, not for going on the web and playing games and watching movies and text messaging and all that sort of stuff. And people that say, I need to get to my kid in emergency, if you walk into the lobby of every school in the city, the parent coordinator's cell phone number is right there, and they'll give you the name, the phone number of the principal's office. In an emergency, call the school. They'll decide if it's a real emergency, which is not, incidentally, does your kid want fish or beef for dinner? And they'll get the kid if it's an emergency.
All right. I've been asked to ask you by some of my colleagues. What you meant on your website about it's time to get real.
I think that it's time that the candidates for that want to be president should tell us explicitly what they're going to do, how they're going to pay for it, and what doing it is going to cost us in terms of not doing other things, because you can't do everything, instead of promising everybody a chicken in every pot with no cost, which I think the American public is smart enough to know is not practical. You tell us what you're going to do, and if you're going to do it, what the impact is. For example, if you want to tell us what you're going to do about the war, and if you do something, what's the impact on the rest of the world, on our energy supply or our obligations to allies around the world or bases or Americans? If you're going to tell us about immigration, if you want to control who comes from where and that sort of thing, fine. But what happens to those people who are already here? What happens to those jobs that are being filled? Who's going to fill those and that sort of thing? And you go right down the list. Everybody wants better health care. Great. Who's going to pay for it? And there's just no free lunch. Unfortunately, everybody tries to, in a 10-second soundbite, are you going to reform healthcare? Yes, I'm going to give everybody everything for nothing. Next question. Mm-hmm. That's just not real, and I think it's time the public demanded answers. I think the press, the Fourth Estate gets special privileges in our society, but they have an obligation. The obligation is to actually do the reason, perform the function that we are giving them those special privileges for. It's to tell the public what's really going on.
In the format that we've got right at the moment, though, the time restraints prohibit that. And I'm thinking of television more than anything else, and these debates that have been going on.
I think the debates are ridiculous, totally ridiculous. But, you know, if the candidates were to stand up and say, I can't get my message across that way, I'm not going to do it, I think the networks would change. What are they going to do? If nobody shows up, they don't have a program, so they will change to do that. And listen, there are other formats. They can come on your radio show. Mm-hmm. You know, you give them an hour, and you can ask them a question and follow up. That doesn't make any sense, Senator or, Congressman or whomever you are. Tell us. And it's not just for presidential candidates, those running for Senate, those running for Congress. They should have an obligation to answer that as well.
And with the use of the Internet now, a candidate could flesh out the message on a website in perfect detail.
Absolutely right. There is no excuse anymore. You're 100% right. You can get your message out, and then the press can read it and summarize it if they want.
All right. I think America's screaming for leadership. Of true leadership, not just some sort of.
Well, they're going to have their opportunity. There are a number of Democrats and a number of Republicans running, and the public has got to hold their feet to the fire and then go out and vote.
What do you say? We'll take a break right here. When we come back, we'll open up the phones. 1-800-848-WABC. It'll be your chance to ask. We continue with Mayor Michael Bloomberg here at 77 WABC. Your chance to ask the questions. We're going to start with line number 3 here. And Bill. Bill, go ahead. You've got the mayor's ear.
Hi, Your Honor. Thank you very much. Your Honor, I've been trying for the past couple of months and dealing with president of the Chamber of Commerce in Brooklyn and the president of the Coney Island Commission. I do volunteer work for the United States Air Force out of Manhattan. And I'm very successful in bringing air shows to New York, and I do not accept a penny to do it. I've helped Macy's get flyovers.
Bill, what's the question?
The question is, when are we going to get a really good air show in maybe Battery Park, Coney Island, Queens?
Well, nobody loves airplanes more than Michael Bloomberg.
Yeah, I'd love to see a great air show. I don't know. I'll ask our Parks Department and see. It may be that... because it's overcrowded areas, it's not the same thing as having it way out in Long Island.
Well, maybe.
But, over the harbor, and they have been flyovers and that sort of thing. I'd love to see it.
All right, Billy, thanks a lot for the phone call. 1-800-848-WABC, line number 4, Bruce out in Long Island. Hello, Bruce.
Good morning, John. Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
With the recent arrest of 12 more crooked politicians in New Jersey, I was wondering what your thoughts would be on why New Jersey has such a culture of corruption, while New York has relatively few corrupt politicians.
Well, I don't know. My mother comes from New Jersey, and so I better be nice to say nice things about New Jersey. I just don't know. I mean, you do read about an enormous number of people getting arrested, but, you know, sadly, nobody has a lock on corruption. There are bad people every place. I think what we need, we should only worry about our state, but we should have, agencies in the state that really keep looking. In New York City, our Department of Investigations, run by Rose Gilhern, is just so scrupulously honest and careful. We have an investigator at every single agency in the city, or all the big ones certainly, and we look, and we've gone so far, hold your breath, 6 years without a major scandal. Let's hope it continues. You know, there's always, you find some inspectors that got bribed here and there, but relatively few. Having said that, we've had, we had some Brooklyn congressmen that, went to, or a state assemblyman that went to jail, and, you know, a county leader.
A bunch of them in the assembly.
Yeah,
in
absolutely.
The legislature.
Yeah.
So, again, as you said, nobody is immune from this sort of thing. Thanks, Bruce. 1-800-848-WABC, line number 5. Hello, Joe in Queens. You've got the mayor's ear. Go.
Yes, John. I want to ask the mayor about the congestion pricing. In 1978, we had less than 10,000 taxis. I know that because I drove one. And private limousines. Now, today, you have over 40,000 cabs, plus more black limousines. This past Tuesday, you had a strike. The city was beautiful. The air was very clean Tuesday. I had to go to the hospital. Of course, I'm a disabled person and come into Queens. I don't know why we have to issue so many medallions.
Joe, number one, we have about 44,000 people who have licenses to drive yellow cabs. But there are only 13,000 cabs, and there's a certain number of those that are always in the shop being repaired or owned by individuals, and they choose not to drive. So at any given time, you know, probably 50 or 60% of all cab drivers aren't working, and probably out of the 13,000, 11 or 12,000 are on the streets, and they do seem to be busy. The problem is not so much that you have too many cabs, it's that there's a lot of parts of the city where the yellow cabs don't go, and that's where the black cabs, the so-called dollar vans, fill in, and, you know, it's capitalism providing a service. Some people can find ways to make money where others do not. What happened in the last couple of days, I think, in terms of congestion because of the strike, there were, no matter whose numbers you believe, just take a look. There's some real numbers we have. You can look at the holding pens at Kennedy Airport, which are clocked, I think, electronically. And there were not very many cab drivers that stayed home. I'm sure there were some over and above normal. You know, it's probably 80% of the cabs were still out there, maybe more. And because of the zoning where the cab drivers could make a lot more than normal, cab drivers that thought about staying home decided these were not 2 days to stay home. These were the 2 days you wanted to be on the streets.
All right. Well, we're just about out of time. Now, there's no more time for another telephone call. Unfortunately, real fast, though, congestion pricing. Would the people that live in New York have cars in New York be immune from that, or would they have to pay?
No, there's a lower, if you live below, according to the original proposal, we'll see what comes out of it, below 96th Street, you pay half price if you have your car in that zone. And it's true, incidentally, if you go out and come back, some people say that's not fair, or come in and go out, it's the same traffic.
See you next Friday.
Looking forward.
Mayor Michael Bloomberg this morning, Chris Wallace on our Friday get-togethers coming up next.
News, opinion, passion. This is the most listened to news talk.